history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, maybe it's someplace like Orem, Utah, no matter where you are, there are some men and women around you who have incredible stories to tell. And if you take the time to listen to those stories, sometimes you'll be amazed. You'll be educated, entertained, so often inspired like we are when we visit with members of our greatest generation. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And some of the story of this gentleman has been preserved and passed on in a book that I've got linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. It's called Lesser Heroes. The author is 90-year-old Zane Taylor of Orem, Utah, served with the 35th Infantry Division during World War II. On the cover of his book, you'll find a teenage version of Mr. Taylor clutching an M1 rifle. Still have an M1 rifle. Is that the same one, one of the same ones you used in the war?
No, I came on a stretcher to the United States, and so I got a rifle after. I have the overcoat. I have a hand grenade. I have my medals and stuff.
Including the Purple Heart and the Combat Infantry Badge. And we're going to hear about how you earned all those things. But I want to talk first, before we get into the war, about your childhood. Because growing up in Utah, you didn't know there was going to be a World War II. You didn't know you were going to be drafted. But I'm sure you had some ideas of what you thought you were going to do with your life. What do you remember about those days?
Of course, we were in the LDS Church. And so all through the younger years, we were taught that we would go on a mission. And so we grew up going to church and playing out in the countryside. Ephraim, where the Snow Junior College is just full of places like quarries, mountains to climb, shooting the BB gun. And we had more fun than anybody because there were so many places to go, and I had a couple of buddies. We'd ride our bikes to the mountain and climb to the top. And my mother was very, very helpful. She took me to all the lyceums at Snow College, which means that when a soloist, a piano soloist, or any special program came into Snow College, she drug me up there as a boy. I learned to appreciate good music, good people, and Snow College was kind of a special place.
I saw the piano when I walked in. Is that something you play, or?
No, my mother started me, and then I told her I had to earn some money in the summer, and I quit, and I'm sorry. I've been sorry ever since. My wife is an excellent player. She plays in church every Sunday, and she's very good, and she sings like an angel.
Well, and you never would have met her if you didn't come home from World War II, which we're going to get that story. You know, another thing I like to ask every veteran that I have on this show about is a date that everybody seems to have some kind of memory about, December 7th, 1941. Do you remember how you found out that the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor?
Very definitely remember, because Sunday afternoon after church, we went down to a swampy area by Ephraim, and that froze over for miles. And we sent got hockey sticks, pucks, and the whole works, and set up hockey game. And we were down there playing hockey when some people drove down out of town to this skating place. And that's when we found out about the Pearl Harbor on December 7th. And it was a shock. But as a boy from 16, 15 on, I always listened to little old radio about the Russian-Finnish war. I kept track as a 16 to 18 how the Russians and Finnish, how they were fighting. And I was loved the little radios we had.
So you knew there was some turmoil in the world, but this still must have been quite a shock to the system that now America was under attack. Did it occur to you that this might be something you were going to be involved in some point?
My friend and I thought nothing was going to happen until we're 18 and we're only 16. And so at that time, we didn't think we'd ever get in a war. But we knew about it, and we read every article in the paper. And it was very interesting to keep track of how we build up our armies, navies, and air corps, put war plants in the next town to us where they made parachutes. Everybody worked like crazy to make this war successful. I call it a team effort by the United States.
And that's a great point to make. And, you know, the title of your book is Lesser Heroes, and some of those heroes are the ones we don't think about that were here stateside doing a lot of the jobs that the guys overseas weren't here to do anymore. But you would end up overseas because Uncle Sam decided to draft you. Were you ready for that?
We prepared because we found out that this test was available to go to college.
In the Army Specialized Training Program, ASTP.
It was ASTP. We both passed the test and were happy that we were going to college.
But as so often happens, especially when it comes to World War II, the things you expected weren't the things that happened. Tell me what went wrong, how you got derailed in those plans.
Well, when we went to Georgia, they said all the people who went to college still had to have 13 weeks of basic infantry training, which we thought was great to do, have fun. It was hard work. But when they found out that they needed more infantry, they disclosed the program as for us. And we went to North Carolina, Maryland, finally shipped out of Boston. We were trained, really trained good in Georgia, because when we got North Carolina, they said, "Oh, you guys have already been trained. You're ready to go overseas." So they took all us guys out of that. We were going to be the 100th Division, and they took us out, shipped us to Maryland, where they make the final touches on us to get us. So we wanted to go overseas and punished us all they could to make us feel like we wanted to go. They were so tough. Running through gas chambers, shooting ranges and everything. We were well prepared to go over.
As a teenager, what were you, 18 when you headed overseas?
They held us up till we just turned 19. There was some word came back from the wars that we were killing 18-year-olds. So a couple of days after I turned 19, I was on my way over. 6 months to get ready. 6 months over there in either the hospital or the war, and then come back 6 months in the hospital, way back.
That journey over across the Atlantic. Had you ever been on a ship before?
No, we didn't know what a ship was. I didn't know what seasickness was. We were on a big ship, but we finally hit some rough water, and all the guys on that ship, we had thousands of infantrymen on the ship. We slept in hallways and all over. I don't know if there was anybody that didn't get sick, but when you get in a narrow channel with stairways, you're locked in, and I think even I got sick for a couple of days out of I think it took 6 days. It's a good ship, fast ship, but even I got sick.
And did you know what kind of unit you were going to be in, that you were going to be in a rifle squad, or were you kind of curious who you were going to be with?
Yeah, we didn't find out who we were with until we landed on Omaha Beach, which was secure. It had barrage balloons all around with nets hanging, so the enemy couldn't strafe the whole place.
Yeah, because those balloons were there, prevented those air attacks. And this was about a month after the invasion when you guys got there?
2 months after. And then we walked a long ways and got on a train. They took us up to just barely past Paris. And that's where they said, you're going to join the 35th. It's on the line. They're online.
So at this point, when you got there, you didn't know where you were going to be. You're replacement troops for somebody who's going to need them.
They didn't tell us where we were going. Or I didn't get the word, because going up that beach, steep hill, with a load on, even though it was safe, it was still scary. And we could really visualize what those guys went through. The first day, there were about over 5,000 killed the first day. Yeah, it was scary, and there were ships all over dumping tanks, cars, trucks. And
so you find out you're going to this 35th Infantry Division, the Santa Fe Division, and I imagine when you join an outfit like that, there's probably some guys in there who've been through a battle or two. Did you have anyone that was a little older that gave you a little sense of what you're in for?
Yes, my squad, they hauled us as close to the front line as they could in trucks. Then we got out in trucks, and we had to walk probably 2 to 3 miles in the forest. And then they assigned a couple of guys to each squad in the forest. And they just moved along, and the guys were able to. My squad was in the forest and went in there, and they were all old guys. They were really old, and they'd build little teensy tiny fire down the ground. And I go up, and my Sergeant Lee introduced me. They didn't hardly look up, but they had whiskers, and they were old, and shells were coming in at night. They'd land here and there and around about us, and I finally got hold of my Sergeant Lee. I said, "Hey, I'm afraid of those shells. They're going to give me the first night I'm on the front line." He said, "Oh, don't worry about it. They don't know exactly where we are." And he said, "Just go dig a foxhole next to Kerrigan," which is one of those guys. "Well, where's Kerrigan?" "Oh, he's in the village getting some really good food to eat." And he said, "Just dig in with him, move his hole over so there's room for you." And I thought, okay, Kerrigan wasn't there. And I got in, I was so tired of walking and all that, and I went to sleep. Pretty soon I hear somebody hollering. It was Kerrigan who'd come back, and he says, "What's this guy doing in my foxhole?" They'd played a joke on me. They were all over there laughing because I got in with Kerrigan. Nobody slept with Kerrigan. But I did that night.
Yeah, they sure did set you up. And you say that. You told your sergeant, "Hey, I'm scared these shells are going to get me." I'm glad you brought that up, because I don't know if any of us who have never been in combat can really understand the level of fear or concern that you have. Did you think you were going to ever see your family again?
No, I was sure I was going to get hit some way. It took me about 3 weeks before my mind could accept. But the question was, where are you going to get hit? We knew if you got hit in the head, that was the sun, or that was the end. If you got hit close to the heart, then that was about the end. But you could hope for an arm, a leg, or feet, get something down below, a wound, so you could get off the front line. Well, this group here of my squad, we just survived. We'd get a few new guys about every 2 or 3 weeks, and they'd disappear because they got wounded or shot or something. So we were pretty fortunate to go 4 months and still have the same guys.
And those guys, including Zane Taylor, are pictured on the front cover of his book, Lesser Heroes. I have that linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. As for the kind of hazards they had to survive, Mr. Taylor will walk us through that when we come back, and we'll also find out why he wears the Purple Heart. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Evert's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and three locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Evert's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Hearing today from 90-year-old Zane Taylor of Orem, Utah. He served with the 35th Infantry Division in Europe during World War II as part of a rifle squad. Help us understand what that means. What were those combat situations like for you? What did you have to do and what did you have to be prepared for?
I happened to have been in about every kind there was. That's why my wife said you got to write a book, because there were so many things, like strafe by an airplane. While we were marching down the road, we had artillery every few days or every day. Mortars shoot straight up and they come straight down. You don't know where they came from, and they can land right on top of you. Machine guns. I was under three different machine guns in attacking. But every day we tried to move ahead, but that first week we were by a river that was flooded and was acting like a boundary between the enemy and us. And so we went in a concrete bunker. We were in a pillbox, and that had holes. Trouble is the holes were pointing the other way, and so we had to walk out on the side the enemy was. If they saw us walk out, they were shooting over at us, and they were trying to hit the pillbox. So we couldn't get out in the daytime. So that meant you had to go out at night. And then we finally left us, and then my first attack was the worst. And that means we lined up in big long lines, and sure enough, we hadn't gone less than a mile. We hit the enemy, and they knew exactly where we were, and so they dropped shells, artillery shells on us. And I made a record in digging a foxhole faster than anybody in the world. I was digging, you know, you dig a hole first for your head, and then when you hear the shell coming, you put your head in there. Then you dig for your shoulders, and then your body, and then your legs. Your feet are the last thing in, because you're hoping maybe your feet would get hit, because then you'd get out of it. And I dug a neat foxhole, but I heard a tree burst. The artillery would rarely hit a tree, but if it did, the shrapnel from the burst would come down instead of just up in the air. And I heard a piece of shrapnel go across my back. And I thought, well, I'm hit right in the back. I just thought I felt something, and when I started to feel around, I couldn't feel any blood or anything. The piece of shrapnel had gone in the side of the foxhole just above my body. It just crossed the top. So that was my first real artillery barrage, and that kind of broke me into where I could start accepting other kinds of things. Like, I crossed three rivers. I crossed one river up to my neck, and I crossed a canal in the river paddling a little boat about 4 by 5 or 6 across the river and canal. And the third river, we were going to cross in these little boats, and I went to the captain and lieutenant, and I said, they'll just shoot us out of the river. We can't cross. He sent two guys up the river, and they found a rope bridge across. The enemy had forgotten to take the rope bridge down. And you saw a whole bunch of guys running. We ran up the river. But you could only get two guys on the rope bridge at a time, because it was bouncing up and down. Mm-hmm. And But we got a bridgehead. We'd have been shot out of the river. It was that.
You're thinking there. Might have saved a few of your buddies' lives. Do you remember the first time that you had to deal with the loss of someone you knew, with one of the guys around you being killed?
First guy, we were on a holding position. We were in a position we could have a little tiny fire. We'd dug foxholes, and we were up walking around. They couldn't get us food. They brought mail, but they couldn't get us food. And I was standing to the side of this fire trying to get warm. Other guy was sitting on the other side of the fire. A guy in a foxhole was cleaning his rifle, and he had it ground level, and when he opened the bottom of it, take the trigger housing group out, he pulled the trigger. The bullet went along the ground level, hit one guy whose head was sticking out of a foxhole right across his head, come over and hit the guy I was talking to in the hip. I drug him, he slid in the fire, and I drug him out of the fire. Never saw those two guys again because one went across the head and this guy was in bad shape, got hit in the butt. And so that's the first guy. That was really hard. We were fortunate in the squad that we were in. We survived.
And I imagine that you guys in that squad, you and these seven other guys on the cover of your book here, you must have all become pretty close when you're going through these kinds of life-threatening situations together every day.
We'd get up at like maybe 5, 6 in the morning, it was still dark, load up with ammunition and food, K-ration boxes, to have some food to eat, and then we'd march off. We had, you know, all day either laying by each other or a couple in a foxhole or just leaning against trees. We had 4 months to get acquainted. We knew each other's history, you know, in that time. And it was fun because this was a neat bunch of guys. And I really felt bad when I found out that Sutherland and Kerrigan, these two guys on here, you can see snow on his helmet.
Yeah.
You know there was snow on the ground there.
At the Battle of the Bulge, I know there was.
It doesn't show snow down here on this picture, but you know what your helmet's for is to sit in the snow. So he didn't get all the snow off his hat, but we sat in our helmets in the snow a lot and visited, and I knew all about all these guys in my squad. We didn't talk to a lot of people in the platoon. In fact, we were the biggest squad. They were about 60%. We'd lost about 40% of our people in the battalion.
40%, that's almost half the battalion that's either killed or wounded, and doesn't that make you feel like I might be next?
Yeah, well, whenever we moved out, we moved out sometimes 2, 3, 4 times a week. Line up in the line and march. Till you hit the enemy, then you dig yourself a hole and try to hit the enemy. Try to crawl up where you could shoot them.
Was there anyone going in front of you guys?
Yeah. Usually we had two guys. We drew cards for night patrol. I've been on 3 night patrols. And who's going to be the scout? We send a guy out in front of this line as a scout. Usually I had 2 of them out there. And they were probably 50 to 75 yards ahead of the line. And the purpose, you know, the purpose of those scouts were to draw fire. Before we all get up there and get shot, they'd get shot. One night I drew the low card. We had, one of the guys had a deck of cards, and we always draw cards for assignments until everybody got an assignment, and then we'd start over. One night I drew for scout.
That had to be pretty unnerving, carrying out that scout duty, not knowing when those bullets are going to be flying at you.
That's one of the hardest things you can do, is be a scout or night patrol, because a scout, that's what you're for, is to get them to start shooting, so the rest of them can find where to shoot.
So did that happen that night?
We got out there probably a half a mile. Nobody was shooting. The officer walked up to me. We'd stopped, and he looked, surveyed. He said, there's a forest up there. I know they're going to be there. We're not going to walk into that whole line. He says, come on back. I was one of the happiest guys. So I'd done my scout duty, you know, and to have him tell me, we're not going to walk into it. It looks like it's really bad. And we found out later it was.
And at some point, the weather starts to change. And while you've been fighting this enemy wearing these Nazi uniforms the whole time, now you've got another enemy in the weather. How bad was that? What kind of accommodations did you have sleeping as an infantryman in the worst winter that Europe had seen ever?
Of course, in Nepal, we always looked when we stopped, looked for a barn, a house. Many times we just go in, a lot of them were gone, and just go in and take their bed. But when it started to rain, the rain was actually worse than the snow because it was hard to cover up. We had a half a tent and we had rain poncho, but the water would get around them and, you know, we'd get wet and the rain worse. But when it started snowing around December 1st, then the snow built up, and we'd always look for a barn or something to get under. That's when we changed clothes, when it started cold. I wore 2 pair long johns, I wore 2 pair wool pants, wore 2 shirts, I wore a sweater, I wore a field jacket, I wore 2 pair socks. I carried extra socks because your feet had sweat and you'd have to change every 2 or 3 days. And I wore a big heavy wool overcoat. I had one. The army towel for a scarf. And then we had a liner for our steel helmet that helped keep us warm. But we were carrying all this extra clothing. Then I was an anti-tank grenadier. Started out, I practiced shooting at a tank before we went online, and I carried 3 grenades. They're heavy in my pack because I had other stuff, but it snowed, and of course the Battle of the Bulge was really, that was the coldest. They said it was so cold. It was 6 below 0 where I was.
You say the Battle of the Bulge, and someone say, oh, my dad was there. I would tell you my grandfather was there. But the Battle of the Bulge went on for quite a while over a very large geographical area. So there are quite a few different quadrants or sections of the Bulge. Explain to us how the 35th Infantry Division was involved and what you experienced there.
We crossed the Saar River into what used to be Germany, attacked across. It took us 3 days to take a little village there and hold it. My job there was to pack the wounded upstairs in a house, lay them out for the medics to doctor up. And I just got to tell you this one story. I went up there about mid-morning after they'd been hauling in wounded guys. And there was a guy laying over on the side of the wall, and he had a hole right in the middle of his breast. They said, we can't do anything for him. We can't get back across the river. He's gone. It was really hard to see a guy just lay there. And then I was also a scout on that crossing. So I went up the hill with the lieutenant, and we could hear tanks coming. We were saved by a P-47. But one of the hardest things was getting across these rivers. I can remember Patton took us out. We just crossed the Blies River in Germany. And he pulled us offline and rushed us, trucked us straight up. We stopped at Metz, 2 nights sleep, and the next day we were on the line in the Bulge. We spent 17 days in the Bulge. We were moving, and one time a sniper loaded down on us. It took us like a half a day to catch him. We had to send guys around in back of him and come into the back of him to find a sniper. He was keeping all of us down. Anyway, in 17 days, I remember the sniper. I remember the end when it was so cold and we had to stand guard at night, you know, and that's from where I got in trouble and went back from the front.
You say you got in trouble. Why don't you tell us what happened? What got you in trouble? You've mentioned the hospital a few times, even being in the hospital after you came home. So what kind of trouble was this?
I hurt my feet. I didn't know they were frozen or cold for 2 days, but I was in 2 field hospitals, Paris Hospital. Flew me to England to a hospital outside of London. Queen Mary on a ship back to New York, put me on an ambulance out to a hospital in New Jersey. Not there very long, and then they put me on a train to Colorado and stayed there. And the total time I was in the hospital was 6 months.
That's a long time. But what got you off the lines was frozen feet. So the Battle of the Bulge is still going on, and you didn't realize what bad a shape your feet were in?
If I'd known, I'd seen some others. Before we moved up to the battle, guys were going to the medic. So I said, I feel funny, I'm going to the medic. I'd never been to the medic. And I went over there for those 2 nights the day before and says, my feet are feeling funny. And they checked and they said, oh, they're fine. So I just didn't feel like it was anything serious till one night we walked into Bastogne, where we'd been attacking to save the guys who were in there.
The guys from the 101st Airborne who were stuck there, trapped?
I had a buddy in there. We had to walk 7 miles to get in there from Forest. And I couldn't figure out what. My feet feel funny. And then my sergeant says, well, tomorrow we'll see. End up a lot worse than I thought.
I guess that's what I'm curious about, and I'm sure our listeners are too. How bad was it? I mean, were you close to losing some toes? Did you lose most of the feeling? Were your feet black? I mean, how bad was it?
Well, if you'll tell these people you talk to buy my next book, they'll have all the details about that. But I did freeze some toes.
You did freeze some toes, is that what you said?
Yeah, they did after amputating.
How many do you have now?
I'll tell you in that next book all about it. I played high school basketball as a senior. I wasn't very good, but it was fun. Anyway, when I got out of the Army, I had planned on playing basketball as a snow college. I figured I could make that team because when I got back, there weren't many guys out of service yet. And so I go out, I tried for, I guess, a week and a half and was killing my right foot. I'd put pads in there and I taped them up. I did everything. I wanted to play. But pretty soon I couldn't, my feet wouldn't take it. So I went out and boxed. They had I'd go out and practice boxing. They'd knock my head off, but they'd just take it easy on me.
But the Battle of the Bulge and those frozen feet cost you your basketball career. They may have saved your life, though, huh? To get you off the lines at that point? Because a lot of guys died from the time you left the Bulge to the time it ended.
You're exactly right, because that did get me off. Each place I went back, I was still thinking I'm coming back, you know. When I left the guys, I told them, I'll be back.
Yeah, you didn't know that you'd still be in the hospital until after both Germany and Japan had surrendered. And you also didn't know you'd still be suffering from those injuries today. We'll explore some of that when we return, and we'll also find out how Zane met his wife of 67 years, Beth. You'll find photos of the Taylors then and now on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page and at hometownheroesradio.com. And we'll be right back after this. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's RV country within driving distance of this radio station. But really, it doesn't matter where you live, because Paul Everett has a fly and buy program that will fly you to any of his locations to buy your new RV. It's one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Serving RVers for 55 years, you'll find Paul Everett's RV country throughout the West and online at rvcountry.com. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Loeffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 90-year-old Purple Heart recipient Zane Taylor of Orem, Utah. He's the author of the book Lesser Heroes, which I have linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. He told us about suffering frozen feet during the Battle of the Bulge. What about today? I mean, you're 90 years old. This is 70 years ago we're talking about. How much trouble do your feet give you even today?
There's not a day go by that I don't feel something. Like I have to wear certain socks and shoes.
Again, you say you hate to say it because you're not looking for sympathy, you're not complaining, but that's the reality. This is a burden you've been carrying for 70 years because of that war.
I'm very willing to carry it because of the way I felt about our country. I would have done anything for this country. And so when I went in, I knew if I ever got there, I'm fighting, and I'll take it, I'll die. I was not afraid of dying, it was how do you get dead, you know? Whether it was a wound or I saw some guys with some bad situations, you know?
And you say you would have done anything for your country, and while you're trying to recover from your injuries, and they gave you the Purple Heart for your frozen feet, right?
Yes. They didn't do it to all of the frozen feet. Some were a lot different than others. But when I got to Colorado, there were hundreds. I'm just glad to be home, be back.
But while you're recovering from your injuries, you find out that 2 of those guys in that picture on the cover of your book, the guys from your rifle squad, that they were killed in action?
Kerrigan and Sutherland. I know the story of this because Fred, this is my foxhole buddy, a little Chicago guy named Fred Pote. He was there when these 2 got killed. I think it was about 2 to 3 weeks after I left. Evidently, the Germans, they would take their artillery and shoot, and if there was a road up there, they'd drop the shells right on the road. They had the roads already zeroed in. And when our trucks came along, they hit right on the trucks. They could do the whole thing. Well, everybody jumped out but Fred and these 2 guys. Fred jumped out and he forgot his rifle under the bench on the side. And then these 2 guys jumped out and a shell went right by him. Well, it killed one instantly. Kerrigan was still alive. They drug him out into the field away from the road where the shells were landing. It took them a while before they could get an ambulance. He got in the ambulance with Kerrigan. And the ambulance driver came and says, "Are you hit?" "No." "Well, you got to get out of the ambulance." He says, "I'm not leaving, Kerrigan." The ambulance driver came in, tried to pull him out, and he pointed his rifle at him. He said, "I'm not leaving, Kerrigan, so just drive on." They went back in a tent. They had these tent hospitals all over. He was sitting by Kerrigan in this tent hospital, and he overheard the officers and doctors over there talking about Fred and said, "He's crazy. He came with this guy, and that guy's not going to make it." He heard him say that. He picked his rifle up and crawled under the tent and hitchhiked back to the front line. He's that kind of guy. Well, he wasn't going to leave until he knew he was gone.
It speaks volumes about the bonds that you had formed, which tells me that when you got that news that Sutherland and Kerrigan had been killed. That must have been really hard for you to process.
Really hard in the hospital to think two guys had survived that long, survived for 4 or 5 months now, and they couldn't go home. One was married and one wasn't married. I felt so bad for the one whose wife wouldn't have him home.
So you're in the hospital when Germany surrenders. What did that mean to you?
Yeah, that was a big thing because in the hospital we kept track. You know, we were all buddies, all had something wrong with us. Making friends, it probably is a lot of those guys got better before I did. I had to go clear to August, from January to August before I was discharged. So you can see it was quite a while.
When it was all over, when Germany had surrendered, and eventually Japan surrenders too, and this nationwide effort that you said earlier, you talked about how this nation came together and that so many people played a role in that. How much satisfaction and pride did it give you personally to know that this enemy, who had done so many horrific things, had finally been defeated?
I thank my father in heaven. I'm so grateful that guys didn't have to go out and walk and get shot at, and on the ships, airplanes. I thank those guys that flew over us. They were on the way to Germany. We had one German strafe us, and we called him Medchick Charlie. He'd fly as close as he dared to the front line and see, he'd try to locate us. Anyway, yes, I had some great feelings when the Germans surrendered and when the Japanese surrendered.
So when you're finally healed up, you go back to college, you go to Snow College, and it's a pretty unique way that you met someone that I don't think you can imagine your life without. Tell me that story. How did you guys meet?
That was really something, because I had this girlfriend when I left. Not that close, that tight, but she wrote every 10 days while I was gone, which means a lot. I received more letters than anybody in the Army total. I had relatives and friends we'd write. Anyway, when I got home, she'd got 2 years ahead of me because I was almost in a year and a half. So she'd graduated from Snow College. She'd gone to University of Utah. Well, it's hard dating between Ephraim and University of Utah.
Yeah, that's what, probably 3-4 hours apart?
Yeah. And so when we became King and Queen of Founders Day.
Wait. King and Queen. Tell me the story. How did you become King and Queen of Founders Day? This is a holiday they celebrate every year at that college, which is still there, Snow College.
They always voted on a King and Queen, the student body, and we all voted. And she lived in a dormitory. I lived in my home, father and mother's home. And I didn't know this young lady until I come out of the gym where I'd been exercising. And that's when that guy grabbed me by the arm and said, "You better go up to the second floor where they post the information on the blackboard." He said, "No, I'm not going. I want to go home." He grabbed me by the arm and says, "I think you better go up there." Went up the stairs, and there was my name and her name on the blackboard. Well, I didn't know her. I asked somebody the next morning, and they said, "Well, we're going to meet Thursday afternoon in the gym, and she'll be there." We met in the gym, and that's the first I ever remember seeing her. I went home that night, and I told my mom, I said, "Mom, I saw the prettiest girl you could ever meet." But the king had to go pick up the queen at the dormitory with the big dress on and suit and take her to the dance. And guess who was sitting in the back of the hall on a seat? A girl from Salt Lake.
Uh-oh.
I was running from my girl down there to this, because I had to take care of this young lady. And a lot of people don't know that we used to sign cards. They had them numbered 1 through 15, and then
the dance card. Now it's just an expression, but it has its basis in reality. There was a dance card.
Yeah, a dance card. Well, I'd run down, dance with my girl, and then I'd have to come back, take care of her.
You were two-timing that night. You were dancing with two different girls, but she still decided to marry you.
We didn't date for a little while, I'm sure. But when we did, it got more interesting. And I just thought so much of her. My girlfriend had come down from Salt Lake on the bus. She came out to my house and said, I think we're through. And she married my best friend. My friend got over from the war. They married each other, and I couldn't have been happier than my best boyfriend married a really great girlfriend.
And you got to marry the one you wanted to marry. And how long you guys been married now?
68 years.
So I'm just thinking back, you know, all the close calls you had in Europe, the frozen feet that maybe saved your life, all these other situations that could have claimed your life. If any of those are different, you never make it home, you never meet her. Your 7 kids, 31 grandkids, and 44 great-grandkids are never born. That's pretty hard to grasp right there.
That is really hard because we just happened to have 7 kids. We lost one daughter with a tumor in her brain, but we have 6 left, and they're the happiest people with the greatest children you could ever imagine. And so we go every Sunday to one of the 4 to live in the valley. They have dinner for us every Sunday.
Well, and it was your wife who told you got to write this book. Why Lesser Heroes? What's the reasoning behind that title?
I wanted to be sure the story was told about all the people in the United States. Even the farmers were working. The shipyards had a lot of women welding, making airplanes and tanks and guns. And I felt like it was a team that won the war. I felt like it was a team that won the war. We had 16 million men from the United States in all of, and there were, how many would you guess were wounded in the Pacific and the European War? There were 650,000 wounded. How many do you think were killed? 400,000 killed. And I found out since reading that there were probably more. Because I speak, we try to speak every other month.
And when you do that, when you go around and speak, and you tell this story of not just what you did, but what you saw and what America was 70 years ago, why do you do it? What is the message that you're hoping to convey?
Well, I realize I only touch a teeny tiny fraction of the people, but anybody that's over 12, say 14 years old, they start to get the message when they're 14 or 15. And I've gone to schools, but I feel that this country is so special. We have the freedoms we do. I'm a registered gun owner. If I want to pack it, I want to pack it. I don't want to give up any freedom. I want these representatives that are in Washington to do what's right for the people and not worry so much about getting their job back every 4 years or 2 years.
You mentioned Washington and our fine representatives there. Speaking of Washington, have you had the opportunity to go back there since they built the World War II Memorial?
I just went back in August, and it was the most wonderful trip.
Was this with Utah Honor Flight?
On the Honor Flight. I've never been treated so royally. They had a wheelchair for all 50 of us. Back in the airports here and back east, people in the airport just stopped what they were doing. We kept wheeling down, and then they took us to all the main memorials, New World War II, the Vietnam, the Korean War memorials, and treat us like kings and queens. Yeah. I'm so grateful for that. I'm sure that maybe the government is helping to finance that.
Not usually. I can tell you for the one we're involved in and nationwide, it's almost every penny is privately donated either by an individual or a corporation. And that's actually one of the misconceptions that most honor flight groups fight is that people assume the government's doing this. The government didn't build the memorial. That was $190 million from people like you, World War II veterans themselves, and the government's not paying for Honor Flight, which is so amazing that the public steps up and does this for you. And when you were there at the World War II Memorial, you mentioned the number, more than 400,000 of your contemporaries died. You could have added to that number easily. When you saw those gold stars that represent that there, what came to mind for you?
I had to shed some tears. I couldn't stop. There were some young people from the schools all over the country would come up to me because we had these hats on and coats. And it was fun to tell them a little bit about it because they were Boy, you'd start telling two school kids. Pretty soon you're surrounded. Yeah, it was very emotional for me. I just so happy I was able to do that.
Well, I think the upshot of all of that is there were a lot of people that felt it was important to say to you, thank you for serving our country. So I echo those sentiments. I thank you for sharing this story with us and in your book, Lester Heroes, and in the book that's still coming so we can find out how many toes you got. Is there anything else that you think we all need to know?
I'd just like to thank you for going after veterans. There aren't many people who could or would do that. So I want you to feel like what you're doing is very important to me and to a lot of veterans.
Well, the privilege is all mine, sir. Zane Taylor of Orem, Utah. I have a link to his book, Lesser Heroes, up for you at hometownheroesradio.com. And I hope you'll join us again next time when we're reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.